we go on to the next talk now, and I'd like to welcome Professor Vogt to talk about Jean-Paul Sartre and the question of humanism.
Thank you very much. According to Robert Young, one has to strictly distinguish between Jean-Paul Sartre's Marxist humanist attempt to inaugurate a new humanism that is to replace the enlightened conception of the immutable nature of man with a historical humanism, grasping man as a product of himself and of his historical activity, and Franz Fanon's truly new humanism, for the latter supposedly dismisses not only the humanism of the Enlightenment and Sartre's historical humanism, but also has to be conceived of as a type of theoretical anti-humanism based upon the recognition that European humanism has been involved in the history of colonialism and racism. For this very reason, one cannot, pays Sartre, separate the issue of humanism from that of colonialism and racism. Moreover, the identification of Fanon's theory with theoretical anti-humanism can also be found in Homi Bhabha's Thermidorian montage of a post-colonial Fanon that is characterized not only by the evacuation of militant thought and politics, but also by the construction of a consensuous realm, a consensual realm negotiating multiple identities, migration, diaspora, cultural synthesis, and mutation, whereby the post-colonial emphasis on hybridity, intertextuality, and third space unbinds critical reflection and militant commitment from the limits of nation, community, or class. That is to say, Bhabha claims that although Fanon's texts are still permeated by certain deplorable anachronisms, in this context, Bhabha mentions Fanonian references to Hegel, Marx, Sartre, anti-colonialism, and humanism. They have to be read in terms of a post-colonial ethics of performativity that operates no longer in the allegedly simplistic framework of anti-colonial politics, but rather examines ambivalent hybrid racial and cultural identities, whereby agonisms and multiple crossings undermine the manichaeism of colonizer and colonized, and creative linguistic crossings and hybridizations, as well as emphasis on the subversive slipperiness of identity and authority, replace, supposedly, the necessity to still debate the question of anti-colonial struggles or of political organization. In other words, the Manichaean space of colonialism is transformed into a hybrid third space that, however, not only internalizes the separations and antagonisms characterizing the Manichaean space of colonialism, but also supersedes the time of anti-colonial revolt through a kind of simultaneity that dissolves Fanon's dialectical conception of the movement of decolonization and insists instead on mimicry and performativity instead of continuing to pursue the liberation of both colonized and colonized. However, Young's and Bhabha's all too facile attempts at drawing a rigid distinction between Sartre and Fanon regarding the question of humanism do not hold. Apart from the fact that already several of Sartre's early texts are incompatible with traditional humanism and perform even a trenchant critique of humanism, it will also be argued that Sartre's analysis of European bourgeois humanism renders evident that the latter cannot be understood without reference to its necessarily inherent racist and colonialist traits. It is precisely before this background of a colonially compromised and racist European humanism that both Sartre and Fanon take up again the issue of humanism by reconceiving the question of the human in terms of what could be called, with Alain Badiou, radical humanism. This radical humanism contains not only several arguments exhibiting an affinity with radical theoretical anti-humanism, but more importantly, it also articulates the emancipatory hypothesis, which is, you know, a code word for a communist hypothesis, aimed at the affirmation of generic humanity. A generic humanity that, according to both Sartre and Fanon, can only be constructed if the project of rethinking humanism takes as its point of departure the exception, that is, that which has no acceptable nature. What is more, Sartre and Fanon's radical humanism distinguishes itself not only from European humanism and from contemporary animal humanism, that is, from what has to be characterized, once again, according to Badiou, as humanism without ideas, but it also engages a complex rereading of the European tradition. Already, Sartre's early philosophical texts have to be seen as largely incompatible with traditional humanist conceptions of the human. Without being able to provide here a detailed account of the thesis that already Sartre's early philosophy is, to a large extent at least, anti-humanist, Let me briefly recall that Sartre, in his The Transcendence of the Ego, develops a conception of self-consciousness that presents the latter as anonymous, differential structure, devoid of any self-identity in terms of individuality, personhood, or even subjectivity. And that in his Lettre à l'Union, he elaborates a conception of the subject that rejects any essence or substance of the human. Moreover, La Nocée, his first novel, written between the two aforementioned texts, contains a rigorous critique of the figure of the self-taught man who deports himself precisely as humanist. Suffice to say that Antoine Roquentin, the novel's protagonist, tears to pieces the preaching of the humanist lesson of salvation. Let me quote here several lines that touch on what the humanist philosopher, or the humanist in general, declares himself prepared to spend to give in order to save one's brother. The humanist philosopher who bends over his brothers like a wise elder brother who has a sense of his responsibilities. The humanist who loves man as they are, the humanist who loves them as they ought to be, the one who wants to save them with their consent, and the one who will save them in spite of themselves, the one who loves death in man, the one who loves life in man. More importantly than this anti-humanist moment of Roquentin's discourse, both Sartre's anti-Semite and Jew and Black Orpheus from the 1940s, as well as Fanon's Black Skin, White Masks from the early 1950s, confront racism in the form of both anti-Semitism and anti-Black racism with a thinking or ethics of equality and universality. For both Sartre and Fanon, the words Jew or Black do not possess any identitarian or communitarian transcendence, according to which their respective fates would not be commensurable with the fates of others. They also do not bind Jews and Blacks to an identitarian or communitarian alliance with a supposedly archetypal transcendence of the other. Rather, both warn that each and every introduction of identitarian or communitarian predicates can only lead to the worst. Both insist that each has to be counted without allowing the fetish of identity to have the final say. On the one hand, both Sartre and Fanon accept the simple fact that there exists an infinity of differences. At the same time, they do not render homage to a discourse of assimilation that will dissolve the infinity of differences into some abstract universality imposed from outside or above. For their understanding of the relation between identity and difference is based on a complex dialectic of same and other. Against authoritarian demands for integration, both insist on the right to be the same, to maintain and develop one's identity. This quasi-identitarian affirmation contains two modes of identity and difference claims. As to the affirmative identity claim, they respect the wish that one's becoming remains within the same. Then there's a negative identity claim that insists against authoritarian integration, that one is not the other. Finally, one can distinguish between an affirmative and a negative use of difference. In the affirmative use, the same maintains itself in its differentiating capacity. In its negative use, the same defends itself against the corruption of the other. However, both stipulate that identities and differences in their negative dimension have to be subordinated to their affirmative development of the same. Both Sartre and Fanon insist on the necessity of traversing different racial identities, a necessity that, of course, presents itself differently for whites and blacks. For blacks have been subjected to a bicolonial racism to discourses and practices of abnormality, whereas white racism is both mystifying and mystified, as Sartre puts it at one point. In other words, the overcoming of alienation presents itself differently for blacks and whites, although one has to emphasize with Fanon that this overcoming must never be misconceived as becoming white, since this would only amount to the reproduction of inhuman white racism. Sartre too claims that whites have to critically examine their own identity and that the abolition of racial differences is not exclusively a cause for blacks, but of course also, and very much so for whites, since whites have been agents and accomplices of a system of oppression in which racism, colonialism, and capitalism intersect in a disastrous manner. Nevertheless, Fanon states that racial identity does not dictate one's behavior and it does not possess special values. Moreover, there is no, as he formulates it towards the end of Black Skin, White Mask, there is no white world, no white ethics, no white intelligence, as he famously puts it. In other words, neither blacks nor whites are. Rather, on both sides of the world, one finds only human beings whose concern is to end, as he puts it, the subjugation of the human being through the human being. Both Fanon's and Sartre's ethical considerations are based on a certain indifference, a tolerant indifference towards differences. They aim at the consolidation of the universal in identities, a universal that must, however, not be identified with some neutral human substance or some common human essence, but that is rather owed to a generic conception of humanity. Neither Fanon nor Sartre deny that human groupings exhibit national, religious, ethnic, sexual, or social features, but they have to be understood as strictly contingent differences, particularly with regard to the appeal that truth to truth that characterizes their respective ethical thinking. The relationship between differences and truth within the framework of an ethics of the universal can be explained in the following manner. Since differences are what exist, and since all truth is the coming into being of that which does not yet exist, differences are that which every truth deposits or lets appear as minuscule. In short, the truth of an ethics of the universal is as such indifferent in relation to differences. It is the same for all. This same is, however, not that which is, but that which comes or arrives. That is to say, the basis of Sartre and Fanon's ethics of the universal are not the very identities already counted, but rather that which do not exist or are not counted. It carries within itself an impulse toward that within itself that will become the same for all. Thus, universality does not simply exist, but is always to be created. Ethics contains within itself an impulse towards a universal truth that each and everybody can comprehend, a truth that is indifferent with regard to particularisms and that points to a situation in which all will be counted as the same. The truth of this ethic contains, therefore, a universal address, that is, with regard to all communitarian subsets, truth is diagonal. It is not authorized by some identity, and it does not constitute an identity. It is offered to all and destined for all, and no presupposed belonging must limit this offer or this determination. The universal truth declared by this ethics is addressed to the equality of all who are different without ignoring existing differences. Rather, these existing differences have to be traversed in terms of an attitude that can be described as I said before, a tolerant indifference to differences, so that universality can be constructed or that the genericity of the true can be unfolded immanently. In other words, differences or identities are significant with regard to the construction of the universal, and they have to be involved in the construction of the universal. The same has to be created, if necessary, by means of transforming one's own alterity. This difficult task does not only require that one identifies the violent or subtle limitations of the universal through the particular, but also that one includes into the analysis of racism one's own position or identity in form of a permanent self-critique. Again, this permanent self-critique is not to be misunderstood as abolition of differences or particularities. Rather, these have to be animated from within with everything with regard to which they are capable of the new discourse. In other words, existing identities and differences have to be animated from within in such a manner that they can be newly subjectivized in terms of an ethics of the universal. Sartre and Fanon's ethics of the universal aiming at generic humanity is based upon the following axiom. There's only one world. How can this axiom be affirmed in a world, however, marked by colonial capitalist manichaeism, that is, in a world of the most rigid separation and division? As is generally known, Fanon's answer to this question consists in the elaboration of an emancipatory politics that, in The Wretched of the Earth, is articulated primarily through the notions of the people and of the nation. As to his notion of the people, one has to immediately point out that it does not succumb to the populist temptation in that it does not represent an identitarian construction, but rather exists as a new reality only through emancipatory struggle. The latter implies that the notion of the people must not be misread in terms of the populist opposition between a supposedly unified homogeneous people and some external enemy. In other words, Fanon's notion of the people does not possess any substantial identity and no objective factors, no ethnic or cultural heritage or tradition, no racial essence, and no historical mission can determine the people, but only and simply the potential to rise up against the colonial capitalist world and to interrupt its Manichaean rhythm. Moreover, it designates a deliberative, emancipatory, and inclusive process of collective self-determination that is not dependent upon some objective historical process or existing forms of authority and knowledge. Thus, it cannot be conceived as simple, quasi-automatic step in some objective dialectic. Rather, it involves collective action and direct participation and is guided by a common, inclusive, and egalitarian interest. Consequently, people designates, in Fanon, the articulation of completely inclusive, completely egalitarian principles that, although their declaration always occurs in specific situations, can be subtracted from these situations in that they do not rely on an identitarian conception of community or on identitarian criteria of belonging. According to Fanon, the nation constitutes initially the most effective vehicle for this articulation on a broad basis, since it is composed of all those who collectively decide to enforce the right to self-determination. The nation is not simply a reflection of social categories such as indigeneity, ethnicity, or race, but is formed in the emancipatory process and does not originate from some culture or cultural essence, but rather from a common goal and from solidarity on the basis of a radical commitment for self-emancipation and self-government. Thus, Fanon is not interested in the question regarding the essence of the nation or of nationalism, but rather in the question as to who constitutes the nation. His answer? The mobile consciousness of the entire people as nation presents the enlightened and coherent practice of men and women. It is nothing but the collective construction of a destiny in terms of assuming responsibility at the level of history. Again, the nation is not something given, but is produced through the actions of men and women. Ultimately, the people and the nation reciprocally produce each other, and this implies that the people and the nation can be understood as something that did not exist before. Fanonian national politics is not only a politics affirming the autonomy and the creative potential of the people, it is also a politics of the masses that is neither reducible to representative administrative politics nor identical to a culturalization of politics. Rather, it inaugurates a new political and social order challenging the allegedly fixed racial, ethnic, cultural, and nationalist identities by conferring on even the most local struggles a general dimension, thereby opening them up towards the universal truth of the world and of a generic humanity. That is to say, the politics of the nation following the criteria of inclusivity and equality and being indifferent to all objective or objectified differences has to be translated into anti-capitalist international socialism. It can lead to internationalism because it is the only effective defense against the degradation of national liberation to mere cultural nationalism in the service of a new nationalist masterclass. There's thus no doubt that Fanonian politics is sustained by the communist hypothesis, that is, by the affirmation of communist invariance, the affirmation of absolute equality, the orientation toward a common world and toward one humanity, the commitment to public self-administration of common property, the militant advocacy of human freedom, and the popular political empowerment of the people, and finally, the intransigent refusal to accept the present as definitive. This communist hypothesis characterizes also Sartre's conception of politics. As a matter of fact, one can claim that Fanon borrows the communist invariants from Sartre in that they characterize the central concept of Sartrean politics, the group infusion elaborated in the Critique of Dialectical Reason. Recall that according to Sartre, politics does not entertain a transitive relation to history or society. The emergence of the group infusion as collective political praxis cannot be derived from given historical or social situations. It does not constitute a potential already existing in historical or social formations that is only to be actualized. It is not inscribed into historical or social reality. The group infusion is not an objective historical agent that would have to be transformed into a subjective force. Rather, its emergence has to be elaborated at the level of its own structure. The group infusion that sets into work disorder, rupture, and explosion is a deeply contingent event. It is not, and at the same time, it is an excess with regard to the state of the situation, to use Bayeux's terminology. It is a revolt against serial alienation, against the proliferation of alterity, and it opens up a new episode of genuine humanity in terms of freedom, equality, and reciprocity. It generates humanity as performative event, rupturing teleologies as well as causal chains. It marks a short circuit between the singular and the universal and the possibility to transform impossibility into possibility. But this passage from impossibility to possibility, again, is contingent. It does not belong to the realm of scientific objectivity and requires the unforeseeable wager of an intervening collective subject. Finally, it carries its justification within itself insofar as it rejects normative criteria and the ascription of external a priori principles. Generic equality is its epistemic as well as political axiom. That is, it involves a generic truth concept that is universally the same for all, and it conquers the universal same by transforming alterity, by rendering insignificant particular identities and identitarian attributes. As free medium of free human realization, the group infusion produces the human being as free common individual, as Sartre calls it, and it renders possible for the other his or her rebirth. It accomplishes this alienation without having recourse to some prior essence of the human. Rather, it describes a process of de-essencing of the human leading to a generic conception of the human and to a truly human world, unfolding the equality of all as truth. The group infusion presents a type of political thinking that is collective, that belongs to all, and possesses an egalitarian address. In other words, Sartre's group infusion can be understood as inauguration of a new thinking of the human and of humanism. This becomes particularly evident in light of Sartre's uncompromising critique of European bourgeois humanism that he claims cannot be understood without reference to the former's inherently racist traits. For European bourgeois humanism is abstract violence and oppressive rule, since it identifies the human being with the bourgeois against the other species, that is, against non-man or counter-man. Humanism, as he puts it in the critique, is a pendant of racism. It is a practice of exclusion, a serial ideology, petrified ideological violence. This type of humanism has four components: the idea of an allegedly timeless human nature that serves the purpose of excluding non-man or counter-man, the spirit of competition, bourgeois freedom, whose limits are demarcated by private property and societal atomism, and finally, the specific hexes in the guise of distinction. European bourgeois humanism is the production site for monsters assembled from a type of humanism pretending to be universal and racist practices. It is nothing but a hypocritical ideology, the sophisticated justification of oppression. Its affection and its preciousness guarantee its aggressions. Thus, nothing is more consistent than racist European bourgeois humanism, because Europeans have been able to make themselves into human beings by producing monsters and slaves. This condemnation, these are all more or less paraphrases of Sartre, to make this very clear. This condemnation of European bourgeois humanism based on a differential schema that attributes humanity only to white Europeans and classifies all non-Europeans as subhumans does not differ, pace Young's claim that I quoted at the beginning, from Fanon's verdict regarding European humanism. And here I give a few quotes, I'm sure well known by Fanon. "This Europe, which never stopped talking of man, which never stopped proclaiming its sole concern was man, we now know the price of suffering humanity has paid for every of one of its spiritual victories. And when I look for man in European lifestyles and technology, I see a constant denial of man and avalanche of murder. European bourgeois humanism is nothing but a series of atrocities," and to quote Fanon again, "the most heinous of which have been committed at the very heart of man. The pathological dismembering of his functions and the erosion of his unity, and in the context of community, the fracture, the stratification, and the bloody tensions fed by class, and finally, on the immense scale of humanity, the racial hatred, slavery, exploitation, and above all, the bloodless genocide, whereby 1.5 billion men have been written off." Now, of course, the number is higher. Precisely in light of this deeply bloody history of European humanism, Sartre and Fanon insist on the necessity to take up again the question of the human, to tense, as Fanon puts it, our muscles and our brains in a new direction, and to endeavor to invent a man in full, something which Europe has been incapable of achieving. Fanon's and Sartre's new humanism is, as Badiou rightly remarks, a radical humanism that is to be grasped as the occupation of an empty place. This project to make the human being arise as the absolute aims at generic humanity to be established in the context of and by means of political struggles. Moreover, this radical generic humanism exhibits, in certain circumstances, an affinity to radical anti-humanism. And I quote Badiou, "Radical humanism and radical anti-humanism agree on the theme of godless man as opening possibility program of thought. That is why the two orientations will intersect in a number of situations, in particular in all the revolutionary episodes. In a certain sense, revolutionary politics create situations that are subjectively undecidable between radical humanism and radical anti-humanism. This radical humanism differs not only from the European bourgeois humanism that, according to its racist colonialist orientation, presents both man and counterman as nature or substance, but also from contemporary animal humanism, that is, from a humanism without program or without ideas, as Badiou calls it. For Sartre and Fanon's, radical humanism projects from its starting point an open figure that subtracts itself from all substantialist categories. More precisely, Sartre and Fanon's anti-humanist thinking of radical humanism projects as its point of departure the monster, that is, the Unwesen of the human, that does not have any assumable nature. However, it is precisely the exceptional conception of the human that grants both Sartre and Fanon the possibility of envisaging generic humanity as what stands beyond every right. And I will stop here to maintain within the limits of time. I just have a few more thoughts about the implication that it has with regard to the question of Europe. But we can perhaps do this in the form of discussion. Do not violate the time. Thank you.
Thank you very much.